CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter. And finally, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors, whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And this week's CFO Radio News came from us today from CFO Magazine, titled Easing the Squeeze, the 2011 Working Capital Scorecard by David M. Katz. And it follows as is. For months after the Great Recession officially ended in June 2009, the need for cash trumped all else. With credit still scarce, companies continued to squeeze cash out of their supply chains. Finance chiefs led the charge to tighten bill collection, loosen their own payment terms, and dump inventory. Today, cash is no longer a problem as corporate offices are filled to the brim. Corporate coffers are filled to the brim. But don't be too quick to credit working capital improvement. The 2% decrease in days working capital, DWC, last year qualifies as downright modest, some say. Although it is certainly an improvement given that DWC increased 9.9% the prior year, the worst performance in half a decade. Remember that a decrease in DWC represents improved capital working performance. Many CFOs disavow any connection between companies' strong cash positions and an apparent lack of emphasis on working capital. How strong? 1,000 of the biggest publicly reporting non-financial companies registered an 11.5% jump in revenue last year, according to the 2011 CFO/REL Working Capital Scorecard. By comparison, revenue dropped by 12.1% in 2009. So is this causing mixed signals? The question should be asked. The energy and focus have now been placed much more on the profit and loss statement, says Mark Tennant, a principal with REL, a working capital consulting firm. There isn't a continuous focus on cash flow and working capital, he says. If indeed bulging coffers are to blame for a new spirit of complacency, the result could be a false sense of security. Corporate balance sheets may not be nearly as impervious as they seem, says Stephen Payne, America's leader of working capital advisory services at Ernst & Young. Despite an impressive recent comeback in corporate productivity, high unemployment continues to plague the economy, he explains. To produce sustainable growth, companies will have to hire people and invest via CapEx, and that's going to start help depleting their cash hoards, says Payne. However, few companies seem poised to do that, see treading water. In the case of US-based multinationals, much of that cash is sequestered abroad and more or less unavailable domestically, thanks to 35% tax on repatriated profits. Nevertheless, the stress that led many companies to try to wring cash from working capital during the recession has been eased by some signs that consumer demand is beginning to rebound. If sales forecasts continue to improve, corporations are bound to put more resources into driving revenue than into process improvements. At the Kroger Company, which recently celebrated its 29th straight quarter of growth in food sales, for example, there's little doubt where its priorities lie. Acknowledging that he sees an opportunity to derive as much as $600 million cash via working capital improvements at the $82 billion in revenue supermarket chain, finance chief Mark Schlottman says he would only go about it gingerly. As the CFO, and I'm quoting here, as the CFO, I could easily get it out and say I've got a few hundred million dollars of cash, he says. But if it hurts sales, that's really not such a great accomplishment. Well, thank you for that article from CFO Magazine. Today, joining us is Lorraine Waller. I'd like to give you a little bit of a background on Lorraine. Lorraine is joining us today as RBC's Director of Regulatory and Government Affairs. Lorraine's primary duties are to provide legal support and strategic advice to senior business, banking, and consumer banking lenders. Now, prior to this role, she was EVP, Chief Operating Officer, and General Counsel for the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, and previous to this was the Senior Vice President, General Counsel, and Secretary for Metris Companies. She serves on the Board of Directors of Grace Christian School in North Carolina. And just as a little bit of an intro, Lorraine is a dynamic attorney with a unique perspective based on a varied experiences with the Federal Reserve Board, U.S. Senate, and leading financial institutions. She's an accomplished professional with significant experience in federal and state banking law, consumer protection law, mergers and acquisitions, and also corporate governance. Lorraine has a track record of providing senior executives with timely and effective legal and strategic advice, and her areas of expertise include bank regulatory, general corporate, government relations, and then also mergers and acquisitions. Lorraine has a JD degree from Harvard Law School and a BA psychology from Yale University. My goodness. Well, welcome to the show, Lorraine.
Thank you, Lorraine.
You have quite an esteemed career and an educational background, and we're very excited to have you on the show. What I'd like to do, Lorraine, however, is to start at the very beginning. What was your first job? Was it a paper round? Was it working at a supermarket? What did you do, and how did that bring you to your current position today?
My first job was working for my father in a construction company as sort of a summer intern, let's say, more practically a gopher who just ran errands and did a lot of clerical type work for the leaders of that corporation. I always was interested in going to law school. I also worked at a very small law firm every summer I was in college, and over time that led me to law school. I clerked for a federal trial court in western Pennsylvania and became interested in banking.
Goodness, so that banking field and some of the money aspect came in very early on for you.
Yes, I got interested in it because I started working as a lawyer right at the time when the banking laws were relaxing to allow banks to really grow. And so it was exciting and a lot of new products, but also the ability to buy branches in different states. You weren't limited to just your own area anymore. And it was really seemed like it was going to be an area that had a lot of opportunities for a young person.
Well, I'm very interested in this path that you've taken, Lorraine. Was there anything in particular that led you from psychology to law?
Psychology is actually a very good major for a lawyer because it helps you learn about and study human behavior. And in fact, one of my favorite courses in college was called Psychology in the Law, and it was taught by a professor who was a consultant for lawyers and helped lawyers focus on trial preparation, pick juries, how to present your defendant, and actually sit through trials and advise the lawyers. So I think there's a very strong connection, and it's helpful.
That's fabulous, and I will say, and from my perspective, anybody that has gone through a psychology background, you certainly understand behavior, relationships, people, how the brain thinks, emotions. That must be very helpful for you in your day-to-day job.
I do think it's helpful. I think it helps me in terms of planning. I think it's helped me want to be more inclusive when I'm working on projects. It's helped me to lead projects from a role that's not strictly a legal role, just a project manager role sometimes. So I felt it was good training for me before I went to law school.
Well, that's fabulous. Well, Lorraine, we are a financial radio show, and so we're going to focus on areas of the financial world that you deal with, and certainly the financial institutions and banking is a very key element to the economy that we're in, and certainly the times. Money doesn't travel without the banking relationships behind them. So let's start. What are some of the high-risk elements that you believe are facing the banking industry at this time?
It's a time of a lot of change in the industry and a lot of change from government requirements. Some of the biggest risks are increased capital requirements. There are new requirements for more capital, and more is expected in the next 6 to 9 months from the Federal Reserve Board. Another high-risk element has to do with how Congress is going to resolve the insolvency of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and how's that going to impact banks that are in the mortgage lending business or banks that are in the mortgage securitization business. And a more general comment is just the large number of new regulations that have occurred in the last few months and are expected over the next year and a half. It's a large amount of work, and it's got costs associated with it.
Well, let's. I would like to talk about that last comment in terms of the regulation area, but I'd like to expand upon something that you said a little earlier in that response, Lorraine. Give the readers, the listeners of the radio show today, if you would, a little bit of background into the Fannie and the Freddie that you mentioned, and how that is impacting the regular bank, the high street bank, if you will. Some of our listeners may not be familiar with the interrelationship of that.
Well, lots of small to mid-sized banks, when they make mortgage loans, make them fit the requirements that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac set out, and they sell them to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, or they sell them to another big lender. Now, with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in difficulty and Congress talking about either liquidating them, putting something new in place, and in addition, the regulators putting together new standards for mortgages that are going to be allowed to be bought by, let's say, Fannie or Freddie, it changes the kinds of mortgages that you as a lender can make, because many lenders can't afford to make these mortgage loans and keep them all on their books. They need to sell them. Well, if the requirements are changed for loans to be eligible, then it changes what you're allowed to do. And then there's the broader implications if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are changed drastically or are no longer available. You don't necessarily have enough government or secondary market support to have traditional 30-year mortgages as we have them today.
And so could that have an impact in terms of the I guess in the industry it's called products, but the nature of the mortgages that are offered to the general public?
Yes, there's a definite concern that some of the proposals that are being talked about right now that would require borrowers to put down larger down payments, to have less debt, would impact the type of mortgages that banks can loan and borrowers can get. The concern from banks is that you'll be able to make less mortgages because less people will be able to qualify. And from a broader consumer perspective or concern about your community, it could be more difficult for first-time buyers or moderate-income buyers to be able to get a home if some of the proposals being talked about with requiring these high down payments actually become the standard.
And one of the impacts that may affect the general public and will have a direct impact on the economy from that could potentially be that house prices at that point in time, they're going to react to the market elements of fewer buyers that are coming in. That first time house pricing will be impacted. I certainly know, being from Europe and having some dealings within my business further afield, that there are countries in the world that you cannot achieve the same element of loan on a mortgage. The percentage of down payment, for example, in India on a majority of loans may be upwards of 60 or 70% down payment in order to get a 20 or 30 or 40% loan. And many other countries of the world ask for a third or more. And so the US has been, one might describe, lenient on the consumer over time, and perhaps is the US maybe now catching up with some of the experiential history that has occurred in the rest of the world?
But people are definitely looking at examples of how mortgage industry works in other countries. One of the proposals that is floating around would require 20% down payment. And as you know, within the last decade, people have been getting mortgages with sometimes no down payment or five, and it's become such that in our industry, the standard is pretty much 10%. So to raise it to 20% would have an impact on consumers and the mortgage market, because if you have a situation where it's more difficult for first-time buyers to buy, then it also becomes more difficult for move-up buyers to change homes because they can't sell their original home. And given the current housing situation and the large number of foreclosures, the timing is pretty harsh in terms of helping the economy to continue to recover.
Sure, and I would imagine if there were individuals that have purchased a house and the mortgages were at that 10%, they may be, if you will, trapped in a time warp such that if they wanted to sell that house to buy the next one, the next house they had to put down 20%. That may slow that portion that would potentially be the resellers to the first-time buyer as they move up in their house, and that would potentially slow down the supply of those houses.
Yes, that's definitely correct.
Well, wow, that's a significant element, and certainly even if you're not looking to take out a mortgage, that would potentially have a strong impact on the economy, and I know we're going to talk a lot more about the economy. Before we do so, Lorraine, the third element of your question there, you'd mentioned changes in the regulations and the regulatory arena. Give us a little bit of a backdrop, if you will, into that.
Well, the past year, Congress passed the most sweeping financial reform in probably well over a decade, referred to in the media as the Dodd-Frank Act, named after the two lead sponsors of the law. It is a huge law, literally, I believe it's over 2,000 pages, and it dramatically changes the landscape in which banks have to operate. And it was passed. It was a one-year anniversary last week, and there are a lot of regulations that the federal agencies have to pass to implement the law. But the changes are dramatic, overwhelming, and a lot of work for banks to comply, and a lot of work for the regulators. They are really struggling to get the work done and get it done in a timely manner.
So what were the significant changes that this law has brought in? And I say that knowing that very often legal aspects, law changes, require a little bit of time, and it may be years in terms of time, for cases to be brought such that we understand the ramifications of the law. But what do you see happening, and what were the significant changes from the Dodd-Frank Act?
Well, there are three ones that I've been focusing on helping our business people adjust to. The first one that has gotten a lot of coverage in the press revolves around changing the profit or the cost that banks can charge on your debit cards. It used to be that the cost was determined by the networks, MasterCard and Visa, and working with the banks, but the, let's say, large retailers felt the price was either too high or they really were not in a position to negotiate. They had limited options. And there was a lot of successful efforts of lobbying and raising concerns that resulted in Dodd-Frank putting a limit on what you can charge for debit card transactions.
So that's good for the consumer in that the cap means they'll be charged less, but from the banking industry, it means profits are down.
Well, actually, it's not good for the consumer. It means that the retailers will pay less. So when you use your debit card at a store, what the store has to pay the bank for the convenience of using the debit card will go down.
I see.
But the consumers are not going to see any benefit from that because it will, if you're a large store and you have thousands of transactions, the fact that the cost goes down 20 cents, even a dollar a transaction, adds up to be very significant for the store. But for the consumer, it's not. So really, we don't expect there to be any reduction in prices that consumers pay. What you expect will be large retailers with huge volume will save a lot of money. Banks who had been using that income to provide other benefits to consumers on their debit card, such as mine has reward points on it, the banks will not be able to provide those benefits, and banks are restructuring their accounts to take into consideration they're not going to have that revenue anymore.
Sure. Well, that's the first component. You mentioned three.
The second component revolves around the Volcker Rule, which is designed to keep banks from engaging in what is people refer to as proprietary trading, trading for their own account to make money, investing in hedge funds, investing in private equity funds. There's been a feeling that this type of activity contributed to the financial crisis. The flip side of it is that banks often use this kind of activity to hedge their risk, and banks feel that they need it and that this is not the kind of issues that led to the financial crisis, so that the fix is going to make it more difficult for banks to operate in a way that is, let's shall we say, less risky. And that for large banks with active managed treasury departments, that's a very difficult situation. And what is likely to happen with some of the large international banks that want to keep doing this kind of trading, they will move those kind of operations to their foreign subsidiaries. So in a sense, the organizations that are going to be disadvantaged are sort of the medium-sized U.S. banks that don't have the ability to transfer that kind of business to a foreign subsidiary.
Understand.
And the last area is also focused on consumers. The law, Dodd-Frank created an entire new regulatory agency, regulatory scheme designed to protect consumers in the area of consumer products like credit cards, mortgages, disclosures, to make sure consumers are treated fairly. And that agency just officially got up and running last Thursday. So that's new. I think that can be potentially good for consumers and good for banks because it can simplify some of the documents that you get, let's say, as part of the mortgage process to actually make them easier to read and less complicated for consumers and less complicated for banks. So I'm optimistic that, yes, there will be a lot of change and a lot of costs, but in the long run, that one can be an improvement.
Sure. Well, Lorraine, we've talked a little bit about the risks that are being faced by the banking industry right now and certainly the Dodd-Frank Act. What strategies are banks using to deal with the unprecedented level of change? Because this is really quite major.
Yes, it definitely is. Well, unfortunately, some of the small banks are worried about how they are going to be able to ramp up in terms of staff and comply with all these new rules. And really, the trade associations that help and advise the small banks expect to see some consolidation in that area because it's just you're going to need enough size and scale to be able to have the staff and the resources to handle it. And when I say small, I'm talking about banks perhaps $2 billion and less. So there's a risk that there will be less community banks in small areas. The other thing that banks are doing is they are really revamping and taking a look at how they put their products together. I mentioned on the debit card where many banks have already decided and written letters to their customers saying, we are no longer going to offer you reward points on your debit cards. And many banks have put together teams and also brought in outside consultants to look at their checking products, revamp them, their credit card products, and then once the mortgage area gets settled, they're going to need to look at their mortgage products as well. And then the third big sort of change in strategy is more on trying to ensure that you have a lot of relationships, let's say, with the same customer. So rules like on debit card would set the prices, sort of reduce your flexibility to compete on price for a medium-sized bank where I am. And so we are changing our focus on how we actually service clients, and that has resulted in even a change in staffing, so I'm creating some new positions where the role of the management team on these new positions is to focus on service, more products to the same clients, the whole relationship and the whole life cycle of a customer to try and be able to meet the customer's needs throughout a family life cycle, when they're starting out, when they're saving for college, when the children are in college and retirement.
And it's an interesting environment in which we live. When I think back to my early childhood, my parents had a relationship with the local bank manager. And that person today and back then was highly esteemed in the community. To be a bank manager was quite something. But today, internet banking, online banking, do people still go into the, what I'll quote, store branch? And I would imagine that the knock-on challenge of that is once a customer has one product, the ability to sell them another product, if you never see them, are we talking about more email traffic, more direct mail in the mailbox?
It depends on what customer demographic you're talking about. We see a focus when you're talking about, let's say, people who are younger or just more comfortable using electronic means. And that means to gather more products with that type of customer means increased and better use of technology. So you may have seen a lot of advertisements for banks that have a lot of mobile banking. So you make it easy for that person who prefers not to come into the branch to be able to do a lot of things. You can now, with some banks, you can, as an individual, not a company, deposit your checks through mobile banking using your phone. So that's for that segment of the population, you have to increase your technology offerings and make it easier to transfer funds, make it easier to do everything together on the internet or online, and to link your different products together. For other customers, perhaps ones who have had a little bit more time to accumulate some assets, they may not come to the branch very often either, but with these relationship managers we have, you would actually have some one-on-one calling on these customers, like small business customers that we target in our marketing. The relationship manager would go visit them, perhaps quarterly, update them, talk to them about what products they need, and arrange for them to get those products through the right product manager. And that person would not be coming to the branch regularly either.
Understand. And some of the technology that you've talked about, I remember in the 1996 Olympics, there was a commercial on television where one of the, customers went up to what looked like a Coca-Cola machine. It was a vending machine, and they tried to put the dollar bill in, and it kept spewing the dollar bill out, and that customer walked away. And then the next customer, he or she was dressed pretty trendy, came up kind of skipping along with a cell phone in hand, just tapped some things into the cell phone and out dropped the can of Coke. And I certainly, from a personal perspective over the last decade, have met some people from foreign countries. And about 12 years ago, met somebody when I was doing some work with UNICEF who actually lost her phone. She was from Japan, and she lost her phone on the plane ride over to Atlanta. And she was in a panic because she couldn't pay her mortgage. And all of her payments were connected through her cell phone. And the audience around were just not used to the advancement that she had. And that was a dozen years ago.
Wow. Well, that's pretty far in advance. That is some cutting-edge technology. And it's quite attractive to many people. When there are some customer surveys done, some of the larger banks who have most of that technology already in place will find that people are willing to pay a little bit more in fees to have that type of convenience and that type of service.
Mm-hmm. So what will all this have as an impact to the on the banks? What kind of impact can we see, do you think?
Well, as I said, I think we are going to see more consolidation. For the last couple of years in the current economic situation, the merger and acquisition activity has been dampened down. I do think that's going to change because you're going to need more size and scale. I believe you're going to see more banks analyzing their products and deciding what type of, I'll call it backroom servicing or processing, it makes sense for them to engage a vendor and no longer do themselves. So I expect to see more use of third-party vendors for medium and small-size banks. And perhaps less differentiation on products. We're going to more differentiate on services and a lot of investment in technology.
So will that mean that some of the little guys that are out there today, the little banks, will be swallowed up by the big banks?
I think so. I think some of the little banks are going to band together. In my hometown, within the last 6 months, I'd say two banks that were roughly each just under $1 billion decided to have what you might call a merger of equals. One didn't acquire the other, but they decided they were going to have difficulty handling the cost alone, but together they thought they could make it work.
Well, in that regard, certainly your bank, your employer, RBC, has gone through a change, and certainly the announcement recently of PNC, there is some merger and acquisition going on at the stages of the large banks as well.
Yes, there is. And RBC Bank is roughly $28, $29 billion, and sort of that regional bank size is a little difficult to manage now, and I think we'll see some changes there. People will, in that size, will decide, are they going to be able to be effective at that size, or do they need more scale, or do they want to size down and be sort of a niche performer? But I do think, obviously, RBC Bank has made a decision which way is in their best interest, and others will be making that similar assessment over the next year or so.
Sure. Well, Lorraine, while I don't want to ask you any specific questions about that acquisition and the transaction that is going through, we wouldn't want you to discuss that specifically. Let's look at transactions in general. Can you talk to us a little bit about the legal aspect of an acquisition or merger in the banking industry that is relevant to that chief financial officer of the finance function?
Sure. And I have worked on acquisitions in my current role, but also as an outside counsel advising other banks. What I would want to focus on if I were starting a project is for the CFO, who's frequently a leader in all these efforts, to get the lawyers involved early and make sure that you get a complete explanation and understanding of what the legal and regulatory requirements are going to be, because those kind of requirements will impact timing of the different stages of an acquisition, and they're most definitely going to impact the cost and needed to be included in any risk analysis. I've seen occasions in the past where that information was not put together and shared early in the process, and it could be a little bit of an unpleasant surprise if you're not completely versed in what you're going to need to do.
Understand. And we often hear that one of the challenges of any element of performing business can be the challenge of needing outside advisors and the ability to be able to afford those outside advisors, because you are bringing on board highly expert talent, and an advisory role is one of a high risk nature, and so the cost associated with those services tends to be a little bit higher. So it sounds as if bring on the lawyers early on. That would be internal legal counsel as well as external legal counsel, I guess.
Right. Many places use a mix of internal and external when they're doing an acquisition, and depending on the size of your law group. But I was really focusing on, assuming if you had internal counsel, bring them involved in early. And often you mentioned the cost of outside advisors, which can be high. It also frequently can help to have the in-house lawyers play a role in helping select the advisors and also helping to negotiate what you're going to pay for those services. The situations I've been in have been a mix where there was sufficient in-house counsel to do a lot of the work, particularly on the government side, and to bring in the outside counsel and to negotiate the fee arrangements.
Understand. Now, when you bring in that inside counsel, we in the finance community look at the numbers. Clearly, that is an element for us. But the chief financial officer is also going to make sure that there is adequate due diligence. There will be expectations that are set as to any potential merger or impact from merger or an acquisition. And very often that might be some kind of what I will loosely call bulk benefits for two organizations coming into one. Talk to us a little bit, if you will, Lorraine, about what the legal counsel is looking for when they come to the table early on. Are there any particular aspects that are a key focus?
Usually the lawyers are a participant on the due diligence teams and also often work with a very close partnership with the CFO and the finance team. So the legal team will be taking a lead role in looking at making sure the corporate documentation is in place, and that's the board work and the other governance. They also play a key role where they really work hand in hand with the CFO, is examining all the commitments the organization you're buying has. So all their contracts, all their vendor contracts, and where that plays in with the key role with the CFO is to look at what requirements you have, what you need and what you don't need, and then what are the notices, cost, and penalties for getting out of some of these contracts.
Obviously,
and that's where you need to work together. The lawyers will figure out the requirements, talk to the CFO about the cost, do we need it, should we try to deal with this immediately after we close. That's a huge area for the lawyers on all those contractual relationships.
I understand. And when those two organizations combine as one, there may be elements of contract on one party's side of the equation that might be better placed for the organization to continue on, but there may be some from the other organization that perhaps have additional benefits that you might want to bleed in. So there, it may be a combination of negotiation. There may be different vendors. The legal aspects are obviously looking at the risks and contractual obligations that the two partners combined may now have.
Right, right. And decide which things you want to continue. And sometimes it's a cost issue, and definitely the CFO is going to be analyzing the cost and making those types of risk determinations and then working with the lawyers to figure out the best way legally to get to the result that's best for the company.
Sure. Well, are there any, let me back up a little bit. CFOs are commonly a lead role during an acquisition. Not only would they potentially have the department that reports to them that would go out and seek potential companies to acquire, products to acquire, and so forth. That being said, what have you learned about the mistakes that CFOs make prior to or during or after an acquisition? Are there any elements that stand out for you?
I think there are a few things that I would suggest could be good to do that some I've seen others do, and one area that I would characterize as a mistake. What I've seen CFOs do that I think was very helpful is to put a member of their team on the finance group on each of the, I'll call them, due diligence groups. So if there's a group looking at something that seems perhaps not so directly related to finance, suppose we're looking at all the risk reports, have a member of your team at least sit in on those team meetings and report back to you. So as you, as the CFO, have an idea of what's going on in all the due diligence areas, not just the ones that focus on finance and contracts, that will help the CFO get a good handle on where the potential risks are to the ongoing plan of increased cost or problem areas or where you want to put your focus in the future. Another thing that I would say I've seen done that it can be really helpful is if after the acquisition, when it closes, we do a post-acquisition review. Put a team together, look at the process, identify what works well, identify what we could do better, and update what we call our acquisition playbook. In the past, I've seen that led by a project manager, but I think it would work well if the CFO or a senior member of his team was leading that effort and was involved in that effort to help plan for the next acquisition, improve your process. And then the last point I would make involves what I would characterize as a mistake for a small startup organization. They planned an acquisition, signed an agreement with a closing date several months in the future to allow time to go to the market to raise money to fund the acquisition. In the meantime, market conditions changed. It was no longer advisable to raise money in the market, and they did not have a backup place in plan. It took some time to get a backup plan together, and in the interim, they missed the closing date for the transaction and had to pay some penalties to extend the closing date. So I would think that, yes, you may plan have your plans in place of how you're going to fund the acquisition, but for a new startup organization like that, you really need to have a backup plan and know what you'll do if things change and be able to execute on that quickly.
That's an interesting aspect that you mentioned, Lorraine. I'm sitting here somewhat turning in my mind a comedy aspect of, isn't it funny that a banking institution may be the last to the table with having found the funding? There's kind of a comedy part of that. But let's talk a little bit about that. When a company is going through an acquisition and the company is a bank, how do they fund it? Is it private investors? Is it hedge funds? Is it institutional investors? How does that work?
Sometimes the organizations actually have the cash if they're larger or established, but it's often through issuing stock, issuing preferred stock to raise the money, sometimes through private equity funds, and sometimes it's through a long-term payment plan. But often it's a combination of cash on hand and issuing preferred stock to raise more money. And then there are also sometimes an ability to borrow some money.
And
the situation I was involved with, where I noticed this mistake, that definitely the plan was to issue preferred stock in the market to raise money.
And, of course, market conditions can very much impact that. Shareholders don't want to come to the table when the market conditions vary on a downward trend.
Right. And they ended up getting the funding from a private equity fund, but it took time to put that in place, and it also involved providing some director spots to this private equity fund in order for them to make what was a pretty large investment.
And so the impact of that is on the post-acquisition side, now you have somebody on the board of directors that is from outside of your what we'd call inner sanctum, and they're making decisions and able to impact the decisions going forward.
Yes, that is exactly what happened.
Interesting. Well, Lorraine, always this comes with a little bit of a disappointment. We are coming towards the end of the show, and that before we do so, we have a tradition on the show to ask our guests their CFO tip of the month. From the perspective of legal counsel and your seat in the banking industry, what is yours?
I'll go with one that's based on my personal experience. My CFO here where I work is a person who's a little bit more open than what I've seen, and what he's done that has worked very well is to share a simplified version of the balance sheet, how we're going to make the yearly goals with a broad group of colleagues. Not just the senior team, a big group gotten together at a large facility. And I thought that was very good to share information at a level where you often don't get the CFO talking about the balance sheet and what has to happen to make the yearly goals. It seemed to motivate people when they understood, and it was coming directly from the CFO. I thought that was good.
That's fabulous. That's a great tip. Thank you for sharing, Lorraine.
And you're welcome.
I'd like to formally thank you, Lorraine Waller, our guest of today, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO from as you see it in the legal perspective. Thanks also to our contributor, CFO Magazine. And thanks to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. To Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website can be found at www.financialexecutives.org. And also to National Association of Corporate Directors, Advancing Exemplary Board Leadership for Directors by Directors. See their website at nacdonline.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.